Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. And as a quick reminder to everybody who's joining us live, if you go down to the bottom of the show page, you'll see the chat room. That's a great place to roll in with the usual suspects. And if in the course of a show you have an observation or if there is a specific question for our guest you would like for either Eagle One or myself to address, that's a perfect place to do it. We'll try to fold it in as best as we can going forward. Also, if you're new to the show or you want to just catch up on some shows you may have missed, you can always get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio. Now let's get on with the show. As we said in some of our pre-show work describing what we're going to talk about today, there is always a question that people want, or really more of a comment than anything else, that those that forget the past are doomed to repeat it. And there's also in the profession of arms always concern when you're through with one stage whether, as you prepare for the future, you're going to try to fight the last war as opposed to preparing for what you're most likely to face. And trying to find that mix is always a challenge, and one that we're going to spend today to talk about with somebody I think is going to be a great guest for that. Our guest for the full hour will be John Nagle, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Army retired, author, lecturer, and he's also been a very much gained since he has left active duty, from think tanks to the service academies, helping grow the intellectual future. John, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Great. And it's kind of funny, with looking at your background, a good Army guy from West Point with a PhD, spending some time at the Naval Academy. So if nothing else, that gives you a good excuse to come talk with us here on Midrats. And what I wanted to kick us off with is, most people are familiar with your work, and you're the author of the book Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife on counterinsurgency. And one of the central themes of that was, are institutions, in this specific case, the U.S. military, a learning institution? And I know it's been a little over a decade since all of a sudden people found an interesting title that seemed germane and started passing your name and your book around. And here we find ourselves midway through 2013, Iraq's a couple of years in the back, rearview mirror. Pretty much the J-4 shop is taking over Afghanistan as they get ready to go home as well. And when you sit back and look at, as we're looking towards the future, back to when you were working on the book that kind of kicked your name above the ambient noise, have we developed into a better learning institution on the whole, or if some of those habits that you outlined and addressed, are those still pretty well ingrained?
That's a great question, and that question is so important that that it is in fact the reason why I'm appearing on the show today to get to talk about that. And I was delighted this morning to see that my friend, colleague, mentor, H.R. McMaster, had a wonderful piece today in the New York Times under the title The Pipe Dream of Easy War that really goes to the heart of this question. H.R. is very concerned that, as I am, that after Desert Storm, we learned the wrong lessons from that war. We believed, too many of us believed, that the revolution of military affairs was not just real, but was the whole answer. And that in future wars, as in Desert Storm, our enemies would present themselves to us in battle array, and we could destroy them with our overwhelming capabilities from the air and the sea and the long-distance precision systems of our ground forces. and that, that future wars would be clean and precise and sterile. And what we found out in the attacks of September 11th and then the long, grinding counterinsurgency campaigns in Iraq and Afghanistan, we learned, as HR says today in the New York Times, that war is political and human and uncertain. And after that, that incredibly searing experience in Iraq and in Afghanistan, I'm afraid that we are making the same mistake that we made after Vietnam, that we are swearing never again, that we will never again engage in these long, hard, slow, messy counterinsurgency campaigns, the ones that the T. Lawrence of Arabia, compared memorably to eating soup with a knife, messy and slow, he said. And after Vietnam, we decided we weren't going to do that anymore. But our enemies have a vote, and our enemies decided otherwise. And now, after another searing experience with counterinsurgency, as after Vietnam, we are turning again, too many of us, I think, to technological solutions, to a belief that in the future we're going to see first, hit first, destroy our enemy first. And I think that the blue services, the Air Force and the Navy, are particularly prone to those mistakes. The mistake not in developing those capabilities, but in believing that that is all we will need. And so I think that there is a real concern that we're going to make the same mistakes again, and HR was concerned enough about that possibility that he wrote this excellent piece that I hope you'll link to in the New York Times today. And one last thing before I step away from that idea, which is the reality of sequester. As many of your listeners know, the severe, unplanned, frankly, ridiculous cuts to the Department of Defense are putting such budget pressures on the services that many of them are returning to what they know best, like best, feel most comfortable with. And I'm afraid that's further reinforcing our natural tendency to go toward what we're good at rather than what we're likely going to need.
As you look at what we've done, what the potential for us to do wrong is, what is the – do you have a right path that would be best for us to follow?
Well, the first step on that right path is reversing sequester and moving back to at least giving the Department of Defense the flexibility to make cuts as it wants to rather than across all budget lines. And once the department has that kind of authority, I think we are going to have to make hard choices. We're going to have to draw down our ground forces. The ground forces are readily expansible in time of war, as we learned during the late phases of the war in Iraq when we fairly rapidly increased the size of the army by 50,000 troops. So ground forces have to remain expansible. And to do that, I actually recommend, I've been recommending for goodness, I think 6 years now, that at least some of the army become a cadre force of advisors, which would be rank-heavy, would be rapidly able to be expanded into additional divisions, brigades and divisions, should we need those again for a large-scale conflict, but in the interim would preserve some of the hard-earned lessons of the last decade in terms of cultural competency, language skills, and perhaps most importantly, the ability to build national security establishments, military forces in other countries, something I think that clearly we haven't done as well as we would have liked to, either in Iraq or in Afghanistan, a problem that's bedeviling us now in Syria that I think is likely to continue to be the most imminent challenge our military forces face for the foreseeable future, for the next decade. Meanwhile, we do have to invest in high-technology blue systems in the Air Force and in the Navy, long-legged systems. I'm afraid we're over-investing in short-legged tactical fighters. I'm very excited by the progress the Navy has made with the X-47, with flying unmanned systems off of carrier decks. I think that's the future. Because even as the so-called Arab Spring, the Arab uprisings across the Middle East continue to roil that part of the world, inescapably, China is becoming a great power. And our actions, our choices can shape China's behavior, can help to shape China's behavior, and just as importantly, can shape the behavior of the nations around China's periphery, which do not want to succumb to Chinese pressure, direct, indirect, do not want to bandwagon with a rising China, the classic balance of power politics. They would rather balance with us against China. But they're only going to do that if we're a credible power with the ability to project power throughout the Asian littorals. And one of the reasons I'm so concerned about the sequester is that it's limiting our ability to do that, and the cuts that will come next fiscal year will further reduce our ability to project power. So as a military, we're going to have to walk and chew gum at the same time. We're going to have to be actively preserving our skills on the low end, in particular in training and advising foreign forces, and I think we're going to be actively engaged in that fight. I think that's going to be the primary thing the U.S. Army does in the 21st century. And we're also simultaneously going to have to be shaping China's behavior and the behavior of the nations around China by being able to project power into that region from further away than we're currently able to do it. It's going to be a really hard balancing act to pull off, particularly given the sequester and the unwillingness of Congress to do things like raise prices on health care for retirees like me.
I think your comment about the seduction of technology, it's something we've touched on over the years here, because especially in the Navy, I think, and I'm going to cleave off our Marine Corps on this statement because I do not think it applies to them. But unlike the Army and the Marine Corps for the last decade plus, the Navy in particular, I think, suffers from this almost more than the Air Force, but they're pretty close to us, is the Army and the Marine Corps have been forced through being involved in an enemy who gets a vote and who gets to think and gets to improvise, adapt, and overcome on its own. The truth of actual combat makes you readdress concepts, ideas, what works, what doesn't work, what might work, what probably won't, what do you need to do with what dollars you do have. While the Navy, except for some of our special operations forces and our Seabees and stuff, have had the luxury to what I call the lost decade, where we did fall in love, the transformationalist, which was the Navy version of different little buzzwords people use. We fell in love with technology, and we ceased to look back at how one does project national will over the seas in coordination with the other services and our allies, and fell in love with the concept of celestial networks. And you would go into these briefings where it assumed that we would always own the electromagnetic spectrum, that we would always have supremacy, and there was no backup plan, and that we would patrol off a coast that were bereft of population, just nice green hills that we can do what we want to and nobody impacts us. And this, it's nothing new. When you look back at the end of World War II, our predecessors fell in love with the fact that the nuclear weapon changed everything, and everything else was left to wither on the vine until we got kicked in the teeth in Korea, and all those bright, shiny, polished aluminum concepts didn't work as much. And I think we also saw that transition from Korea to Vietnam. And we find ourselves, at least in the Navy, because we were already well into a decade of this, we've kind of stepped on the rake twice with a bunch of our big programs because they're just not working. Where do you see that concern that the Army is going to catch the blue disease, so to speak, and they're looking at programs and concepts that seem to intentionally have blinders on, so they're really not looking at what we've had to relearn in the last decade and a half? That's too difficult. They want to go back to where they're comfortable. What are the big areas you see our land forces going that way, and who are their big advocates in uniform are influential in a civilian outfit that people need to keep an ear out for and counter them in the marketplace of ideas, so to speak?
Yeah, I'm going to come back and defend the Navy a little bit against that horrific onslaught you just launched against it. Not completely, but a little bit, because I do think the Navy has some programs that are working really well. And I'm a particular advocate for the Virginia class attack submarines. I got to take a ride aboard the USS Mississippi, Virginia class attack boat, came in a year ahead of schedule, came in under budget. And I really think we've got those right. And I think we are underbuilding the Virginia class boats. I think we need more of those, not fewer. I'm also a big fan of the Burke class destroyer. I think in both of those cases, the Navy actually does have it right, but is underinvesting in those systems and should be building more of them.
You get full agreement with me there, that's for sure. Those two programs, well.
I've been astounded by how universal, when I voiced that opinion, how universal the acceptance is among commanders and below. And for the life of me, I can't figure out why that word hasn't filtered its way up higher. So as we, as is our wont, as we criticize the mistakes that we see, I do think it's worth giving credit where it's due. And in those two programs in particular, the Navy has it exactly right. We're just not buying enough of them. And we've got to think hard about what the future conflict is going to look like and what the systems are that we have right and invest more in them as we do some experimentation and build, in particular, I think, toward a much more unmanned, remotely piloted future. The Army is making, I think, one big sort of training and doctrine mistake right now and one big procurement mistake. And the procurement mistake is in the ground combat vehicle. The Bradley has not performed perfectly by any means, but when up armored with explosive armor, reactive armor, it has performed very well in a high threat environment. The Army is planning to replace it with something called the ground combat vehicle, which is currently coming in at 70 tons. The Army has decided that it is, after fighting two wars with some reasonable degree of success in Bradleys, which carried only a fire team, it has decided that now on the modern battlefield, we need to put more human beings together in one target and put a full squad inside the new ground combat vehicle. I think that's a mistake for any number of reasons. I think we need to get smaller and more agile, more able to move among the warrens of the streets that many of us saw, in particular in the urban areas of Iraq, where a 70-ton vehicle or my main battle tanks when I was serving there, wonderful as they are in so many ways, were ineffective. We couldn't rotate the turret. The gun tube would hit the walls on either side if we tried to rotate the turret. And so the 70 tons is too big for a fighting vehicle in the urban battlefields that we're more rather than less likely to see in the future. And so that's the big equipment procurement mistake I think the Army is making. The mistake we're making on the training and doctrine side is I think we are or were returning full-throated to a focus on rotations at the National Training Center against the Krasnovian Army, against a conventional military, and certainly during the 10 years of counterinsurgency campaign, some of our conventional skills did atrophy. We were not able to conduct combined arms maneuver as well as we should be, and so I applaud the decision to refocus on that, but not at the exclusion of throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So we have to maintain the skill sets we've paid for in blood over the last decade. We've got to maintain the language skills, the cultural knowledge, the understanding that war is, as HR said, political and human and uncertain as a result of being political and human. And so I'm concerned that the Army, as after Vietnam, is going to focus again on high-intensity combined arms conflict to the exclusion of all else. The big there are two reasons that may not happen. One of them is that after Vietnam, we did have a conventional opponent to focus on with the Soviet Union. That was a credible enemy. It did present an armored threat of the kind that we most like to prepare for, that we most like to train to confront. it's really hard to come up with a scenario in which more than a division or two of the U.S. Army is engaged in high-intensity conventional conflict. There just aren't that many good enemies out there anymore who are likely to fight us that way. I can't imagine anybody, any opponent, looking back on the last 20 years of war, remembering how we cut through the Iraqi army like a hot knife through butter in Desert Storm, but then struggled so heavily with counterinsurgency campaigns both in Iraq and Afghanistan, I can't see how any enemy would decide to take us on conventionally when they have the option to do so with irregular warfare, with insurgency, with armed rebellion. And so I think because we don't have another credible enemy to plan against, to prepare against for conventional war, we're less likely to go full-throated in that direction. Certainly the young veterans, the majors and lieutenant colonels, the captains who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan know what that kind of war looks like and are not going to give up that ghost easily. The other ironic reason why we're not going to go that direction, I don't think, at least not as far as we otherwise would have, is the very fact that the sequester has made it impossible for us to train the high-cost, high-intensity combined arms warfare at places like the National Training Center. The Army has had to cut almost all of its NTC rotations this year, and training dollars have almost dried up. And what that does is allow you to focus, allow you to train for the language skills, the political negotiations, the cultural understanding kind of skills that take almost no dollars to prepare for. And so in an odd way, the sequester may actually allow us to preserve more of the hard-earned counterinsurgency skills that I think we're going to need in the decades to come.
Earlier you discussed a cadre system of as a core, I guess, of an expandable ground force. Is this in an effort to, the biggest cost facing the services seems to be personnel costs, is this an effort to allow us to reduce the size of the force and then expand it as needed? And given the civilian military disconnect, which seems to be growing sometimes, where are we going to get these new troops if we have to call them at cadre? Wouldn't the risk be that the cadre would be sent by itself and we wouldn't really wait for the follow-on troops?
So there are, I think, three advantages to this idea of building what I described back in 2007 in one of the first papers that the Center for New American Security ever published as an advisor corps. One is that we are inevitably going to draw down the ground forces, as we always do after every conflict. We expanded them during the wars, and we are now going to draw them down. When we do, we want to hold on to the literally priceless combat experience that our mid-grade officers and NCOs have gained. And so as we draw down, rather than cutting down evenly across the board, I would like to focus on retaining those mid-grade officers and non-commissioned officers, majors, senior captains, staff sergeants, sergeants first class, and retain them in a unit that is going to hold on to those lessons learned at such enormous cost. I think that those forces will be useful immediately in an advisory role. And currently the Army is devoting more attention to an advisory role, is taking that role more seriously, but it's planning to do so with brigade combat teams. There are very few countries in the world that want a whole bunch of American 18-year-olds with rifles running around, but lots and lots of countries that would like small teams of professional, mid-grade, higher-grade, non-commissioned officers and officers to advise their units in the higher-level skills. And this is essentially a special forces light kind of mission. Demand for special forces exceeds supply, is likely to continue to exceed supply. This would allow a subset of the U.S. Army to focus exclusively on one of the seven special forces tasks, the foreign internal defense task, and I think they would be the busiest part of the Army. The third advantage is that if we do, in fact, need to rebuild our conventional forces rapidly, it's comparatively easy to build new second lieutenants and new privates. It takes about 6 months. it's a lot harder to build a major or a staff sergeant. That takes 10 years. And so this sort of force structure would not only be immediately useful, would not only allow us to preserve the literally irreplaceable, invaluable combat experience we've gained over the last decade, it would also allow us to build a rapidly expansible force in order to reverse the coming force structure drawdowns, if that in fact turns out to be necessary.
A lot of the trends on the drawdown look to be focused on our land services. And when you look at risk mitigation for scenarios just like you described, especially as the active duty forces decline, and based upon how we used them in the last decade or so, are there some things that we can do with how we man, train, equip the National Guard and the reserves that would better position them to be of more use down the road to help mitigate that risk of having a smaller active duty force?
That's a great question. That's exactly right. I have the honor of serving on the Reserve Forces Policy Board under the able and sometimes inflammatory leadership of Arnold Cunaro, who many of your listeners will know. And this is something that the Reserve Forces Policy Board is thinking hard about at the request of former Secretary of Defense Panetta. We owe a report to new Secretary of Defense Hagel in the fairly near future on just that question. And so this is something we're thinking hard about. And it's my belief that the Reserve and National Guard forces of the United States have over the last decade of war really demonstrated that they are not just a strategic reserve. They've been employed in an operational reserve role. They have, at one point, they were the majority of the U.S. troops serving in Iraq fairly early in that war as we exhausted our available supply of active duty forces. And they became, in many ways, indistinguishable from their active duty component in terms of equipment, in terms of training, in terms of combat experience. And they are already, I think, now have a higher proportion of combat veterans than do the active duty force because they tend to retain their people longer. So there's an awful lot to be said for relying more on the National Guard and the Reserve as not just as a strategic reserve, but also in a more operational role in the years to come. I think you're going to see that happening. And I think that that's a very smart way for the U.S. military, the U.S. as a nation, to mitigate the risk that's going to happen as we draw down our forces, as we reduce our defense budget, in what's going to remain a very uncertain and dangerous world.
Well, those of us who have served in the military tend to view the world as an uncertain and dangerous place, but there seem to be a rather large group of people who view the world as but for the military, everybody would be sharing flowers and singing Kumbaya. How do we bridge that gap between those people and the people whose job it is to train people to go out and kill each other and take unusual risks on behalf of their country?
I'm going to disagree with the premise a little bit. I think that the number of people who genuinely believe that the U.S. military is a threat to peace is now outweighed by the number of people on the left who believe that the U.S. military should intervene more often in order to prevent humanitarian tragedies. And here I'm thinking of people like Samantha Power, the recently nominated U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, a well-known humanitarian interventionist who just had her confirmation hearing. And so increasingly, I think, as Vietnam recedes into the distance, as the American public, whether they supported the interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan or not, almost universally supported the troops, I think that there is overwhelming support for the U.S. military and twin phenomena are happening. One is a general war weariness. I believe that we've asked too much of the troops for too long and that it's time to bring them home. But also from people like Samantha Power, from people like Senator John McCain, a belief that there are atrocities happening in the world, humanitarian disasters happening in the world, that only the U.S. military can stop, and that it is the responsibility of the United States to intervene in those situations and stop them. And so I think we're seeing very odd alliances between the fairly hard interventionist right and the interventionist left that are posing some really interesting intellectual questions, and including inside the Obama administration, which has spoken movingly and well, published very good, doctrine on responses to humanitarian tragedies and disasters, but has proven fairly reticent about intervening in those kind of situations, in particular in Syria, but even in Libya, where I thought that the so-called leading from behind doctrine actually worked pretty well, but which demonstrated the very limited ability of our allies, Britain and France in particular, to project power anymore. And so we're seeing, I think we're likely to see for the next decade or so at least, a general diminution of U.S. engagement abroad, in particular if the sequester isn't changed. We'll have fewer ships deploying, fewer Marines afloat around the world ready to respond if there are disasters, man-made or natural. And that is what I'm actually concerned about, is the pullback of American leadership around the world, because nobody else is willing to step up and do what I think needs to be done to preserve the international system, to preserve international peace and security, and to keep the world safe for American diplomacy and for American trade.
You brought up one of my favorite bugbears there, which is Ms. Powers. And the concept that a lot of people may sound familiar to them, that she's known for, but she by far is not by herself, R2P, the responsibility to protect concept. And I think, you know, when people look at things that we have the scale and the ability to do, for instance, at one end of the spectrum, you have humanitarian assistance, like our response to Haiti a few years back. And nobody else has the ability to get that type of tonnage across the beach, you know, whether it's food or guns. Guns or butter, doesn't make a difference. We have the ability to do that in almost a unique way in the world. But then you have a different situation. And I know it's something that you saw up close and personal, the urban counterinsurgency. And when people think back into the far distance of Mogadishu, but really today, Syria, when you look at the type of fighting that's going on in Syria, it's mostly urban. And you don't just have two sides, you have a multitude of sides. And the serious point is, you know, where does that lie in with R2P when in a situation like such as that, where you have a neighbor that has the most interest, Turkey, they're not committed to putting any troops on the ground to stop the fighting. Why does or why would somebody believe that a nation in North America would want to put its young men and women in the middle of that sectarian meat grinder inside that R2P concept? It's really something I'm trying to wrap my head around, because it almost seems as if it's not remembering what we just got through going through.
Great question. I'm close to Sarah Sewell, who is another of the primary proponents of responsibility to protect, or R2P. Sarah, I won't speak for her, but a lot of that came out of the tragedies in Africa during the Clinton administration, and there were in the Rwanda killings, pretty clearly, I think, a brigade of the 82nd Airborne could have intervened, and with the loss of probably not a single American, could have stopped those million people from being killed. And so in that sort, that is, I think, the sort of environment that R2P was initially envisioned to prevent the Rwanda-style massacres. Syria is a much more complicated situation, in particular is a much more complicated situation now. So I actually supported arming the Syrian rebels, supporting the Syrian rebels a year ago, when I believe there was a credible, reasonably unified rebellion that would have benefited from American support. We now know that the national security team of the first Obama term, Secretary of Defense Gates, Director of the CIA Petraeus, Secretary of State Clinton, were unified in their Secretary of Defense, still Gates, were unified in their belief that the United States should in fact intervene to the extent of arming and training openly. And the president made a different decision in that summer of 2012. At this point where we are now, as you noted, there is no longer a unified opposition. There are literally, I think, hundreds of different groups opposing the Assad regime. Many of them are allied to al-Qaeda. There is, I think, no way at this point to effectively choose within the different facets of the rebellion to ensure that any assistance we provide does in fact go to what we would consider to be the good guys. Many of the good guys have been killed by al-Qaeda affiliates over the course of the last year after we failed to intervene at what I thought was the appropriate time. And we are now, I think, at a point in Syria where there are no good answers, where Assad's regime is abhorrent, where many of the rebels, if not most of the rebels, are al-Qaeda affiliates, right, dedicated to the restoration of the Islamic Caliphate and continued attacks on the United States. And we're in the unique situation of not wanting either side to win. And this is an example, I think, of a foreign policy that may have overlearned some of the lessons of the Bush presidency. I think the Bush administration was too quick to intervene in places where it didn't need to. This administration, the pendulum may have swung the other way. And certainly I think the history books are going to look hard at that decision in the summer of 2012 not to arm and equip the rebels at a time when I think it could have done some good. And when there really was a rebellion that we wanted to win, and that window is closed and it's not going to open again.
Well, that has been one of my criticisms over the years of humanitarian interventions, is that it seems like it's very easy to get sucked into something that appears to be, we're on the side of good, truth, and justice, but the matters on the ground are much more complicated than that. And from my experience in the Kosovo adventure, far more complicated, and neither side, particularly, certainly not the Serbian side, but even the Kosovar groups that we were supporting, they're not the most pleasant people on the face of the planet either. How do we learn to distinguish when we really should intervene, and is there some guide, or is it going to be a case-by-case basis?
It is, I think, always going to be on a case-by-case basis, and we are too prone, I think, to overlearn the last lesson and to hesitate to go in too long, as I think we were in the former Yugoslavia because of Somalia. Somalia is a great example of the problem you described, in which what appeared to be a politically neutral act, that is providing food to starving people, what we didn't understand when we got into the Somalia situation was that food was being used as a weapon, and by feeding hungry people, we were intervening in a political struggle, and we were affecting the outcome, and that upset some of the groups who were using food as a weapon, who then turned their weapons on us to dramatic effect. But that Somalia lesson, we overlearned, the Clinton administration, I think, overlearned the Somalia lesson, and that caused it to be, in my eyes, slow to intervene in the former Yugoslavia. The Clinton administration having been slow to intervene in Yugoslavia, the Bush administration was far too fast to intervene in an unnecessary war in Iraq. And so the pendulum swings back and forth, and we are unable, except in the rarest of circumstances, to get it right. And getting it right is more the exception than the rule. I look back on the administration of George H.W. Bush, Bush 41, the first President Bush, and Brent Scowcroft, his wonderful national security advisor, and in Panama, as in Desert Storm, broadly speaking, I think they got it right. They used force effectively. They used force when it was necessary to use force. And we have not seen that caliber of a national security team, I don't think, since those waning days of the Cold War, when I left this out. The most important thing they did was manage the end of the Cold War in a peaceful way in what could have been World War III. And so as I talk to graduate students of foreign policy, national security affairs, I urge them to look at that administration, how that administration did business, the decisions it made that look, as the years go by, they looked good at the time, they look better and better and better in retrospect.
As you know, better than most, I would argue, nothing is ever static. The environment that we work in, it's constantly changing. And you can, just like people, institutions and nations can get into habits. And the last 100 years was very much, and it makes sense, we fought two world wars there mostly, very Eurocentric in the fact that, and that crowning jewel is the NATO alliance that we still have a lot invested in. But when you look at trends in the near term, in the medium term, demographics, economics, world trade, the shift from Europe to Indo-Pacific, it's clear and it's stark. And there's other things technologically going on in the background, for instance, the development of fracking that's decreasing the West and will more as the year goes forward in the near term, decreased Western reliance on the Middle Eastern oil that we've been obsessed with for decades and decades and decades. And you mentioned early on about, you know, what do you need to man and equip range. And range is the most critical thing from the blue side of the house involved with the Indo-Pacific, which I know everybody was talking about the Pacific for a while. I started to see Indo-Pacific come into the lexicon now, which I think is probably pretty good. Though it's come into the conversation in the last year. Are there some institutions that need further reminders of the fact that the shift from Europe to the Indo-Pacific has been going on for a while? And are we really given enough attention as far as intellectual manpower towards that shift? Are we still a little bit too heavy in the European area?
That's a great question. There was a lot in that. I was schooled by Kurt Campbell, the co-founder of the Center for New American Security, its first chief executive officer, who then became Secretary of State Clinton's Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia. So Kurt, a real role model and a mentor, as I understood the pendulum to be swinging away from Europe, away from the Middle East, toward the Pacific. As you say, that shift has been accelerated by, underlined by, fracking and the prospect of the United States becoming energy independent within the next several years, becoming a net energy exporter, a geostrategic shift of enormous proportion, and one that puts huge pressure on China. The United States has largely assumed responsibility for protecting the flow of Middle Eastern oil for the past 50 years, as you said, since the end of the Second World War. And if the United States no longer needs that oil, or certainly doesn't become such a primary user of that oil, then the challenge falls to China and perhaps to Japan, which relies almost exclusively on that oil, even more so since it stopped its nuclear programs, to protect that oil themselves rather than us doing it. So the geopolitical changes are dramatic. Our force posture changes, our force development changes have not been as dramatic, as you note. And this is one of the reasons why I believe so strongly in the Virginia-class boats. I think we need more of those to cover those distances, to remain invulnerable under the waves, and I think we're still likely for some decades to come to enjoy undersea advantages that no other nation in the world can match. I'm not as sure that that's true on the surface. I'm concerned about China's developing anti-access area denial capabilities and capacity, words we haven't used yet in this conversation, but that should fundamentally be shaping how the Navy thinks about its force structure and its force packages. So I don't think that shift, that intellectual shift, has happened yet. I think we are still devoting way too much of our intellectual energy, both in state and in the Department of Defense, to the Middle East and to Europe. And I think Asia is going to be far more important for the rest of this century. It is going to be an Asian century. The United States is fortunate that it is an Asian power. And I'm actually off to Asia myself. I'm spending a week in Singapore and a week in Australia next month, in no small part to try to get a sense of how that shift toward Asia, toward the economies of Asia, should influence American foreign policy. But I think you've identified a real problem.
Well, that I was just making some notes before you said you were going to Singapore and Australia about how do we get Singapore, Australia, Japan, and the Philippines, some of our other allies in that area to help us, I feel like Jerry Maguire, to help us help them protect themselves from the intrusions that China seems to be making into the South China Sea and other areas where they believe they have vital interests.
We're seeing baby steps in that direction, but nowhere near as much as we would like to see. The countries of East Asia, other than China, other than India, are largely small. They're not very unified. We've never been able to establish an effective NATO for the Pacific. The closest we have is probably the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. That is a good political organization, but not yet an effective national security organization. And I do think that we are helped by the aggressive nature of many of China's actions. China has been feeling its power and displaying that power perhaps a little prematurely, and China's actions along disputed island chains, for instance, have been aggressive enough that they have led to things like new agreements with the Philippines. I think the Philippines are feeling the weight of Chinese power. They are looking for more capability. They are looking for closer defense arrangements with the United States. Australia is moving closer to the United States. We're looking at basing Marines on the western shore, the northwestern shore of Australia. I think that that's another good move. Guam, of course, becoming more important as we start to move some capabilities out of Japan. Japan remains a very powerful force, and I think we're likely to see Japan finally stepping out from under the shadow of its actions during the Second World War, starting to act like a normal power, as Germany has proven able to do in Afghanistan to great effect, to the great assistance of the United States. I'd like to see Japan play more of a role, and I think we're likely to see that. All of these states responding to the rising power of China, the threat that that presents, and you can go straight back to Thucydides and the history of the Peloponnesian War. It should be no surprise that as China rises, China becomes more powerful. Its small neighbors get concerned. They turn to the United States, and they ask the United States, are you going to be with us? And unfortunately, I'll return to sequester, because of ridiculous, poorly implemented budget cuts, we are less able to be with them than we would like to be. I am astounded that the sequester's damaging effects have been allowed to go on this long. I was very perturbed to see Secretary of Defense Hagel say that he sees no possibility right now that we're going to see anything except a continuation of the sequester cuts into the next year. And this is exactly the wrong message for the United States to be sending, both to China and to Iran, which remains a real risk, a real threat. In both cases, American power, the threat of American power applied wisely, can shape the actions of potential adversaries of the United States and push their decisions into a direction that is more positive for us, that is favorably inclined toward our own preferences.
failing to show our power is penny wise and pound foolish. It increases the risk of war, and I cannot emphasize enough how damaging it is for our nation, for the young men and women who continue to serve in uniform.
A friend of mine, an Army major, who really cut his teeth on, Iraq, Afghanistan, back to Iraq a couple of times. And one thing that set him back recently is all these junior officers going around with no combat patches. And you brought up that topic earlier, in the fact that we do have a great cadre of mid-grade officers with lots of military combat experience. But the junior officers, because of the change of what we're doing, they're just not going to have that. So what you need to do is to make sure that you're training them right, intellectually preparing them to respond to the unexpected that they're going to run into at some point in their career. And I know you've been involved with your retirement with helping to bring up the next generations of leaders. And I'm always a big fan of the mind often improves or degrades based on what you feed it. And one of my favorite quotes in that line for people, and it was a frustration. I was in active duty trying to get some really smart junior officers, most of which were engineers, who had no interest in reading. A little quote here from General Mattis I wanted to throw out here, where he talks about the importance of reading. He said, and this is a response to somebody who said they were too busy to read. He said, and a little long quote here, "The problem with being too busy to read is that you learn by experience or by your men's experience, i.e. the hard way. By reading, you learn through others' experiences, generally a better way to do business, especially in our line of work where the consequences of incompetence are so final for young men. Thanks for reading, I've never been caught flat-footed by any situation, never at a loss for how any problem has to be addressed, either successfully or unsuccessfully before. It doesn't give me all the answers, but it lights what is often a dark path ahead." End of quote. John, if you had 2 to 3 or 4 books for a junior officer that you could, give them as a stack of books or upload to their Kindle when you're not looking, that have ideas that you want percolating in their brain as they prepare for their career and those that they lead, what are a couple of those books that you can think of?
Well, what a great question. What a great quote. Jim Mattis was my division commander in Anbar province way back in 2004, and I've stayed in touch with him ever since. He actually awarded me my combat action badge in the Pentagon as a Marine to an Army guy. So can't say enough about the service he's done for the nation and the inspiration he's been to generations now of military officers. And I love that quote. I've seen that exchange before and applaud you for bringing it up. So there's the reading list just gets longer and longer. I'm still a big fan of the wonderful book, The Challenge of Command by Roger Nye, which is an Army book. I don't know if you've seen it. Roger Nye, a professor, retired Army colonel at West Point, but in The Challenge of Command, he lays out a dozen books in each of a dozen or so categories: command, training, leadership, logistics, tactics, operational art, that he thinks every officer, by the time he or she is a colonel, should have read. And literally, I checked the books off in my copy of The Challenge of Command. So I continue to think that is one of the best books that every officer should read. It's oriented toward the ground officer, but certainly the leadership, the command sections are applicable to all branches. The whole book, very applicable to the Marine Corps as well as to the Army. One of my favorite books is The Best and the Brightest by David Halberstam. It describes how a very talented group of people led us astray in Vietnam, made a series of decisions that are hard to understand, but it provides insight into high-level decision-making. I read it as a very young officer after Desert Storm and continue to return to it as a very useful way to think about national level decision making. And I think that even lieutenants need to be able to explain to their men and women under their command what national objective it is they're trying to accomplish, what their role is in that. I'm a fan of Fred Kaplan's recent book, The Insurgents. I don't think it rises to the level of either of the two previous books I've discussed, but Fred does a good job of explaining the intellectual ferment inside the Army, really from the wake of Vietnam on all the way through through very recent times, and describes how relatively young officers who are well-read, who understand bureaucracy, who understand history, who understand politics, can have influence when things are going badly. And so I think that Kaplan's book is instructive in terms of thinking through the role of intellect in solving national security problems. Somewhat similar book, Greg Jaffe and David Cloud's wonderful book, The Fourth Star, looks at Generals Petraeus, Casey, Corelli, and Abizade, and tracks the intellectual development of those officers from their lieutenant days, from their pre-commissioning days, all the way through their service with four stars. And so it's a wonderful intellectual roadmap for those young officers. And I'll stop with one more. Tom Rick's book, The Generals, which looks at what Tom describes as a relative decay in the caliber of generalship of the U.S. Army over the years from World War II through Iraq and Afghanistan, a failure pointed out by my friend Paul Yingling in his wonderful, powerful, career-damaging Armed Forces Journal article, A Failure of Generalship. And Tom's book is a book that all of the services should look at as they think through what skill set are they selecting for, what skill set should they be selecting for. And Tom, as well as a study I did at CNAS, a study that Maren Lead ran at CSIS, all suggest that adaptability is one of the key attributes of successful officers that we should all be selecting for, that we should be promoting adaptable officers. We should be preparing our officers to be adaptable. And the best way to do that, I think, is, as General Mattis said, to immerse them in history and politics through books, through discussion groups, through discussions like the one we're having now. And what you really want is someone to disagree with a point, to hear something they hadn't thought before, and to engage with that thought and to work through that thought. We are limited if we restrict ourselves to not reading, if we restrict ourselves to our experience. We have a very limited basis from which to draw lessons out. Far better not to learn from your mistakes, but to learn from other people's mistakes. And that is what professional military officers do. That is what a professional reading program allows you to do. That is the merit of discussions like the one I've been privileged to have with you this afternoon.
Well, I have about 30,000 more questions to ask you, but we're winding down on our time. So let me ask you this. What's up with you next, and where are we going to see you? And are we going to be seeing any writing or other materials from you?
Mm-hmm. So I have recently left the Naval Academy and become the ninth headmaster of the Haverford School in Haverford, Pennsylvania, an independent kindergarten through 12th grade boys school on Philadelphia's main line that has a 130-year history of preparing boys for life. And that's a position I took in no small part because my son is going to be joining the sixth grade. Only have one of those. And I really feel privileged to have the chance to spend the next 7 years of his life as he progresses through middle school and high school with him, getting to know his friends, helping his friends grow in character, in intellect, in strength. And so delighted about that. I am staying on both the Reserve Forces Policy Board and on the Defense Policy Board. So I'm delighted that that Secretary of Defense Hagel has seen fit to keep me on in those roles. So I'll continue to have an advisory role in both of those positions. I'm maintaining a non-resident senior fellowship at the Center for New American Security, so I'm hoping to continue to be engaged in Washington through that avenue as well. And I have written a book thinking about the lessons of the last 10 years of war, how we got there, what we need to take away from it, that is currently at Penguin Press. And Penguin is contemplating a release date of about this time next year for that book. So many of the things that we've talked about today are in that book, and I hope that at least some of your listeners are interested in pursuing that in more depth.
Well, John, thank you very much for taking time this afternoon, and I'm excited about your book. Now we have to wait 40 years. It'd be like waiting for Game of Thrones to come back on, but we're a patient man, and I'd really I'd love the opportunity when your book gets ready to come out and you're starting to walk around and talk about it. We'd love to have you on to discuss it, because I know our listeners would definitely be interested in hearing what you have to say.
Well, I'd be delighted to do that. I can promise far less visual appeal than Game of Thrones has.
thank you very much. Thank you very much for taking the time to be on the show today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure, gentlemen. Thanks for what you do to keep the profession engaged and relevant.
We're glad to. It's our hobby. We really enjoy it. And I want to thank everybody who joined us here live today, and also those of you who are getting us here on the archive. Thank you very much, and we hope to see you again on MIDRATS. And until then, hope you all have a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.